The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program, WMKV, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or staff and management. The information and advice presented are educational in nature and not intended to be taken as specific legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Always consult with your own legal, accounting, or other professional before making any investment. Welcome to Real Life Real Estate Investing, a show to help you gain financial freedom by investing in real estate. Brought to you by the Real Estate Investors Association of Cincinnati and the Ohio Real Estate Investors Association. You're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing on WMKV, WLHS, and the Maple Knoll Radio Network. And now your host, Vina Jones Cox.
Good afternoon. I am Vina Jones Cox, and this is Real Life Real Estate Investing, where every week we search the nation to find you the folks who can help you start or grow your own real estate investing business. Every week, that is, except the first week of the month. And the first week of the month is question and answer week. Because I'm not living in your head. I don't know what you need to know to start or grow your own real estate investing business. For heaven's sakes, you got to tell me. And this is the day where you can do that. Any question about any aspect of real estate investing is welcome here today. And you can get it here to the studio in two ways. Number one, you can give us a call. The number is 877-772-9658, 877-772-9658. The other way is you can send an email. The email address is vinaradio@gmail.com. A couple of quick things happening today and tomorrow in the real estate world. Tonight, we launch our Driving for Dollars challenge. Folks who receive my weekly e-letter, where I asked a question, I don't know, 6 weeks ago or something, and said, I still believe that Driving for Dollars is the best way to find off-market deals if you do it right and do the follow-ups correctly. And yet I know it's hard to convince people of that. So if we were to do like a Driving for Dollars education/contest kind of thing, would you participate? And I got like 100 emails saying I would be all in on that. So we put that together with Cincinnati RIA, and it launches tonight at 6:30 on Zoom with an introductory meeting that's basically, here's how you do it, here's what you're looking for, here's how you figure out where you've already been. We hooked up with Deal Machine to get everybody a free 10-day subscription to their Driving for Dollars software. So you'll be able to keep track of what you've been doing there. And there's the launch meeting tonight. You'll get homework. You'll have until Monday to drive around and identify and tag some properties. And then on Monday, there's a second online meeting that is about, okay, I got them. Now how do I track them down and market to them? And then it wraps up next Wednesday with a third meeting about, okay, now I've got the leads. What do I do at this point? So it's all really cool and it's all really free. Because we just want to encourage people to get out there and stop complaining that there's no good deals on the market. There might not be any good deals in your market, but you can go find them by Driving for Dollars off-market deals. So CincinnatiRIA.com, go there, and there's a thing right at the top of the page. You can click and get a link for tonight's meeting. Oh, and there will be prizes, too. People who do the homework for Monday, there will be a drawing for a free year subscription to Deal Machine, and then there will be a second drawing on the call a week from today, next Wednesday. So again, CincinnatiRIA.com. Speaking of Cincinnati RIA, for those of you who are in or near the Cincinnati area, the monthly Cincinnati area chapter meeting is tomorrow night. The topic is best cash flow strategies for 2024. We all know that everybody's looking for like where is the best, safest, least risk, blah, blah, blah strategy. And We've got a panel of active practitioners who are going to defend to the death their favorite strategy. We got somebody talking about higher end rentals, lower end rentals, apartments, notes in private lending, lease options, like every cash flow strategy we could think of. There will be somebody there saying, this is why I think it is the best one. If we could find someone who thought that theirs was the best one, there are a couple that we called about and they're like, nah, this isn't really the best right now. So you can register for that meeting, which is held in the Westchester area in Cincinnati in person by going to cincinnatirea.com. So let me go to the email at vinoradio@gmail.com and pick up some questions that have come in the last month that we were clearly for Q&A week that we didn't cover this month. And I'm also waiting for your email at vinoradio@gmail.com or your call at 877-772-9658. 877-772-9658. This question came from Lisa at the actually beginning of May, and she says, we hear a lot about scammers stealing a homeowner's identity and then fraudulently transferring the property title, basically stealing the property. What do you do to protect your buy and hold properties from title fraud? Well, Lisa, unfortunately, there's not a lot that you can do to protect yourself against this because it's worse than just they like stole your identity and sold the property. Usually this scam is transacted between the scammer and a notary. There's almost always a notary who is involved in this who doesn't care whether the scammer shows them a driver's license with your identity on it. They just will notarize, quote, your signature. I mean, I've heard of these deals where a woman owned the property and it was a man who effectively sold it, say, you know, stole it and sold it. And there's no way the notary thought that that guy was you, you know? So if people are willing to be super bad guys, then, you know, what can you do? Except that, of course, you're going to get your property back. You're going to, and it takes a while. I know some people who've had this happen to them and, you know, going to court and proving that you didn't, in fact, sign the document and that it was a forged signature. And there's always, of course, a victim on the other side of this. And the victim on the other side is whoever they sold it to because they accepted a fraudulent deed, but they did put a bunch of money. I mean, they legit thought they were buying a house. So you got to untangle all of that. And here's the thing that's really bothersome about this and the reason why you hear so much about it. A lot of states don't have a good way of prosecuting the scammer. So here's what I hear over and over. Somebody stole my house. I went to the police and they said, well, this is a civil matter. I went to the county prosecutor who also told me it was a civil matter. And so what I ended up having to do was just go to court and prove in a civil court that I did not sell the property and I got my property back, but nothing happened to the scammer because it was civil court. He didn't go to jail. Now, every time I hear that, I think, okay, if he stole your $20,000 car, he would go to jail. If he steals your $200,000 house, the county prosecutor refuses to do anything about it because he says it's a civil matter. That just seems insane to me. So there are several states, including Ohio, thank goodness, that are considering legislation that would define that as a crime and define the punishment for it. And if somebody was going to go to jail for doing that, they might think twice about doing that. Right now, I think most of these scammers are pretty clear on the idea that they're not going to go to jail. So worst thing that happens is you get your house back, and maybe in civil court you sue them, or the buyer who paid them all the money for it sues them for a few hundred thousand dollars, but they're never going to collect, so it doesn't really matter. I will say this, the people I've talked to, they seem to be targeting free and clear houses. So keeping a mortgage against your property could provide some asset protection in that scenario. It could be a loan from one of your entities to another of your entities. You don't necessarily have to go out and get a bank loan. The other thing, and this was, I know this was absolutely epidemic in Philadelphia about 10 years ago, is they target houses of that are vacant of people who are either elderly or deceased. And the assumption is, you know, if they've been deceased for 5 years and the property's still in their name, then nobody cares about it. Nobody will notice that it got stolen. And if they're elderly and the house is vacant, that they're not paying attention to it and no one will ever notice that it was stolen. So, it's nuts that people can do this and effectively nothing happens to them. And if everything goes well for them, nobody will notice that the property was stolen. But to me, that should be a pretty serious crime, subject to a pretty serious jail term, for the simple reason that it's a huge theft. It's a gigantic theft. And they defrauded the buyer as well, right? It's a theft from you. I heard of a case maybe only 6 months ago where when the owner who had the property stolen from them took the thing to court, the scammer had not sold it. He still owned it. In other words, he sold it to himself. And he agreed to give it back. And the county, after 6 months of loss of use by you, he agreed to give it back. And then the county prosecutor said, well, he gave it back. And I was like, but see, if he had stolen my car and kept it for 6 months and then brought it back, you'd be prosecuting him, right? I mean, it's weird. It's a weird hole in the law that, if your state doesn't have a solution for that and or are not considering it, you should call your local state representative and say, hey, we need a law about this and here's what's going on and here's some examples of it. And the politico, no matter which side of the aisle he's on, is probably going to say, yeah, we should have a law. So, yeah. I'd say do that, Lisa. And thank you for your question. It's question and answer week. 877-772-9658 is the number to call. You can also send an email to vinaradio@gmail.com. Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Vina Jones Cox. My guest today is you, because it's question and answer week. So you ask questions, I do my best to answer them. 877-772-9658 is the number to call, or you can send the question in to vinaradio@gmail.com, as Jonathan did. Jonathan from Miami. And, this is a question that literally an all-day seminar could be taught on, but I will try to give some insight here. He says, when acquiring a partial interest in a property, there are lots of mechanisms that can be used. A percentage ownership through the deed, so tenants in common, a percentage ownership of an LLC that holds the deed, a percentage owner of usage as a beneficial interest in a trust. What are some of the typical consequences we have to consider when choosing these different structures? For example, anonymity, risk exposure, unfavorable taxation, complexity, cost change, etc. So in thinking through this question during the, you know, minute and a half of the break, and how I might be able to give an answer that is not completely complete, but is at least sends you down the right path, Jonathan. The first thing I thought was, to me, it's not so much about the anonymity, risk, unfavorable taxation, etc., as it is about what are the needs of the two parties who are partnering on this deal. Because, for instance, if somebody is coming out of a 1031 exchange, so they've sold a property, they're getting into this new property as part of a 1031 exchange, the percentage ownership of an LLC idea, like the way we're going to own it, is the LLC will own it and you and I both own however much percentage of the LLC, is probably not going to work. It's going to most likely need to be a tenants in common interest. And it doesn't matter what these other things are. You know, it doesn't matter what the risk exposure is, or that's how it has to be if I'm using 1031 exchange money. Now, again, I could go off on a sidetrack for 5 minutes about how, well, if the property I was holding before was in a trust, I can actually exchange into an interest here that is beneficial, the interest in a trust, or as long as it's got the same owner. But that's unusual, all right? In terms of things like risk exposure, obviously ownership through an LLC or ownership in a beneficial interest of a trust are kind of better for privacy. But usually, even in a tenants in common situation, it's not that you and I own the property together. It's that your LLC and my LLC own the property together. And the fact that there are two of us with two LLCs doesn't change the asset protection effect of the LLCs. Complexity is a very interesting question, because I used to, whenever I'd partner with somebody, I would form a new LLC. We would have shares in the LLC based on whatever our contributions were to that LLC. And what I ended up with was about 20 different LLCs and 20 different tax returns for 20 different LLCs. And sometimes if my partner was like out of state or something, then there was, you know, whatever reporting requirements there were to that state. So I more or less stopped doing that. It would take a special situation for me to want to start a new LLC to own a property. And that special situation would probably be that it was a property that deserved its own LLC. It was an apartment building or a big commercial property or something like that. And that I was going to have multiple partners involved. That would probably be the least complex way to do that. The complexity that people don't think about, and this, I think, goes to your cost to change thing, is whatever you do, whether it's tenants in common, whether it's ownership interest in an LLC, whether it's a shared beneficial interests in a land trust, you have to have an agreement. And with the LLC, it can be built into the operating agreement. With the other two, it needs to be a separate kind of joint venture agreement that outlines the conditions under which the ownership might change. And that needs to be very detailed. So, for example, I have a partnership with another investor that is actually, if you look at the ownership, it's a trust. The trust is co-owned by my LLC and her LLC, but there's a separate joint venture agreement that outlines my job is to put the deal together and provide the money to hold the property while it's in renovation, and then to manage it after it's renovated. Your job is to provide the money for the renovation and renovate it, and then take care of any major, like we'll send somebody over if the faucet's leaking, but if it ends up needing a new roof, you're going to oversee that as well. And after it's rented, we will pay for that out of reserves. You don't have to pay for that. If either one of us doesn't do our job, so if I just drop the ball on the management, or if you just drop the ball on general contracting something here, then what happens? And the answer in the joint venture agreement is, if I stop managing the property, she can hire a manager, and the entire management fee comes out of my part. Because it was my job. We shouldn't be splitting the cost of a manager. It was my job to manage it. If she doesn't GC the roof and I have to GC, I have to get somebody to GC the roof, the entire cost of that part of it, of overseeing it, comes out of her side because that was her job and she didn't do it. It also, and all of my partnership, all of my joint venture agreements have a buy-sell clause in them that says if one of us gets unhappy with the deal, here's how we decide to, you know, go our separate ways. And the answer is almost never by selling the property, because that's just like, if you like the property and the other person doesn't like the property anymore, you shouldn't have to sell it to satisfy them. So it says things like, you can make me an offer under which you would either buy my half or sell your half. You can say for $100,000, I will sell my half, but then I get the right to say whether I want to buy or sell under those terms. If you say you'll sell your house for, you'll sell your half for $100,000, and I think the whole property is only worth $150,000, I'm going to say, great, buy it, buy my half for $100,000. And you have to do that because you're the one who made the offer. It also says things about who we can sell the other half to, because, you know, she might say, and this is true of all my partnerships, she might say, I want out, and I say, I don't. And she says, well, buy me out, and I say, I can't. And so she can go sell her half to somebody else, but I don't really need to control who that is, but I need to be able to approve the partner. If it's somebody that I'm like, oh my God, I wouldn't do business with that person on a bet, I don't want her to be able to sell her half of the property to that person, because then they become my partner. And I'm sure she feels the same way. I mean, I'm sure there's people I could pick that she'd be like, oh, no. I'm not going to be in business with that person for the next X years. So any of these things could be good structures. It does depend on, do the two partners need something in particular to happen? For anonymity, the new LLC or the land trust are probably better. For risk exposure, just make sure nobody owns anything in their personal name. They're all basically going to be taxed the same way. I find forming a new LLC for like a single family home to be overly complex just because of the tax reporting requirements. And the cost to change and how it can be changed should always be dealt with in a joint venture agreement of some sort. So, yeah, there you go, Jonathan. Best I could do in the limitations of a radio show versus like an all-day seminar. You're listening to Question and Answer Week, 877-772-9658. You can also send your questions in to askvina@gmail.com. Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Vina Jones Cox. It's Question and Answer Week. So, 877-772-9658 or vinaradio@gmail.com. We'll get those questions to me. Let's go to line one and talk to Randy in California. Randy, welcome to Real Life Real Estate.
Hi, Vina. Good to be with you on your show. Thank you.
Good to have you.
Thanks. My question, just got done remodeling for the first time a manufactured home in a mobile home park, family park. Now I want to sell it. And what would you suggest is the best way to attract people to buy it and I carry the contract?
That is a really good question, and it's a good strategy. Like a lot of people I know who buy mobile homes, they have no intention of renting them, sometimes because the park won't let you, and sometimes because they just don't want to have a revolving door on that mobile home where people are coming and going every year and they have to maybe rehab it or something. So all of the kind of basic things that you would think of, like Zillow and Facebook Marketplace, and those are all good places to run ads. Facebook Marketplace is kind of easy because you can be real specific that this is a home for sale with owner financing. On Zillow and similar, I have found that running your ad in the for rent sections gets you more response than running it in the for sale section, because a lot of people who would be good candidates for what you're trying to do are not looking in the homes for sale section because they don't believe they can buy a home. They're not looking for something to buy because they're like, well, I can't qualify, right? But if you run these ad in it, run these ads in the for rent section, and then say, you know, it's a mobile home, such and such an area, you're in California, so $3,000 a month probably, and then say real early on in the ad that this is not a rental, you can own it for $3,000 a month, then the people who are looking for a place to rent go, oh my God, we could own? What? I need to call. Now, the other thing that I think works really well with mobile homes is actually bandit signs that are offering a property for sale. And particularly bandit signs right around the park, because there could be somebody in there going, oh, my sister needs a place to live, or my mother needs a place to live, or I'd like to stop renting and start buying. And then within like a mile radius, if you put out like 20 signs, and as you probably know, bandit signs can't have a lot of words on them. You can't completely describe the mobile home. The rule is 7 words on a regular like 18 by 24 bandit sign, and one of the words is the phone number. So what you can say is something like mobile home owner finance, $3,000 a month, call this number.
Okay, or maybe no bank required.
Yeah, I always wrote owner finance, but yeah, no banks needed is another good way to say that. I usually have put just like 2-bed, 1-bath, something like that, because you can fit that in, you know, 2BR, 1BA, you can fit that in. But I didn't have a mobile home, but I had a whole bunch of properties for sale one time that I had bought as a package that were, they were owner finance, you know, repair for equity type deals. And I hung up, because I had 16 houses to get rid of all at once, I hung up probably 100 signs in the various areas. And my phone just rang off the hook for weeks. I eventually had to go and take them down because I was like, they're all gone. Stop calling me. I think I logged 178 calls in 3 weeks.
Did you sell those outright, or did you sell those?
No, they were owner finance. No, they were owner finance. And the ad literally said, now in this case, they were repair for equity. So it said handyman special, owner will finance, 3-bed, 1-bath, although I had lots of different ones. So some of them said something different. $500 a month, phone number.
Okay, very good. So my other question, too, is at what point do you say, okay, I will take all cash payment where they go get conventional financing versus selling it on your own? So if I sell it on my own, I'm assuming I'm going to get a higher payment. I'm going to get a higher price. But if I were to sell it outright and get a lump sum payment, I'm willing to take less. How would you look at that?
Yes, that is correct. The challenge, how old is this mobile home?
It is a 78, fully remodeled.
You're almost going to have to finance that, because there's two choices in a 1978 mobile home. Okay, there's three choices if you're the buyer. Choice number one is pay cash. Choice number two is find one of the very small handful of institutional lenders in the country who will loan on a property like that. And put like 50% down and pay like 14% interest. And choice number three is owner financing. And so, yes, I mean, if somebody shows up and says you want $200,000 for it and I've got $150,000 cash, will you take it? That's a decision you would have to make. The last mobile home I had, and this was last year, I wanted to carry owner financing on it. I didn't want to take cash for it. It was a better deal if I carried the, it was a better deal for me if I carried the owner financing for reasons of my underlying financing, okay? And I had a few people that were, you know, they were like applying for it, and they, you know, the park probably has to approve anybody who's moving in there, right?
Correct.
So I had a couple of people that the park wouldn't qualify. I had a couple of people that didn't have what I considered adequate down payment, which wasn't a lot, by the way. But I had this one lady who kept calling me and saying, I want to pay cash for it. And I said, I don't want to sell it for cash. And my original asking price was like 148 or something like that. No, it was 140. And she called and she's like, I'll give you 120 cash. And I'm like, I don't want to sell it for cash. And she came back and said, I'll give you 135 cash. And I said, I don't want to sell it for cash. I'll be happy to sell it for 140 with financing. And she said, she came back and she said, I'll give you 140 cash. And I said, oh, you're not hearing me. I don't want to sell it for cash. And she ended up paying me like 145 cash. And I just, I mean, at that point, you know, there comes a point where you're like, I'm just being stupid to not take that. Right. But, you may.
Well, I'm going to keep that in mind too.
You may decide that
I might get lucky like that. So.
Well, I mean, I don't know what your situation. You might be real happy to take a $20,000 discount to get the cash in your pocket. Because of my underlying financing, I didn't really want to sell it. But maybe you're happy to sell it, and if you do, yes, the owner finance price is higher than the cash price. Because you're taking a particular both interest rate risk, right? Because I mean, you might be asking for 12% interest, which is very common in mobile homes of that age. But in 15 years, you might be like, "That was stupid interest. I can get 16% at the bank now." So you're taking an interest rate risk, and you're also dealing with a clientele that, for the most part, cannot get a loan from an institution because they don't qualify, and there's a reason that they don't qualify. Their credit scores maybe aren't great, or their job history maybe isn't great.
Well, to protect against that interest rate risk, do you suggest doing something like a 10-year balloon or a 5-year balloon on it?
You cannot do that.
No.
As of 2010, 2011, whenever Dodd-Frank actually was written, putting balloons in loans to homeowners is verboten. What you can do is you can write an adjustable rate loan, but you need to read up on Dodd-Frank because it's very specific about you have to name the index that it's set on. So you can name the 30-year Treasury bill, or you can name the it's not LIBOR anymore. They changed LIBOR to another thing that I don't remember what the acronym is, and you have to have caps on the rate raising. So you can't raise somebody, even if whatever your index is goes up 5% in 1 year, you're not going to be able to raise the rate 5% in 1 year. You're probably going to be able to raise it 2% and then 6% over the entire life of the loan. And there's a thing in there that says when you're qualifying your buyer, you have to qualify them based on the highest rate that it can be in the next 5 years. So in other words, if let's say you have a 6 point, that right now the rate is 10%, it's got a 6 point lifetime cap. That means unless it's fixed for the first few years, it could go up to 16% over the next 5 years, and you have to qualify them on income as if it were already 16%. So what I see a lot of people doing, if they are going to do a adjustable rate loan, is they will fix the rate for the first X years. For the first 5 years, they'll say you won't have it. You won't have a change in your payment except as taxes and insurance change in the next 5 years, and then after that, I can raise it 2% a year based on such and such an index.
And that's got to be put in the document ahead of time.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Has to be in writing. Now, I let me add that you should really check and see if California has its own law about that, because California has a lot of real estate laws, and they are very homeowner and tenant friendly. So I would check with an attorney who understands that in California and see, because they might have a stricter law than Dodd-Frank.
Yeah, great suggestion. I'll make sure I get that written up with an attorney. But does that mean if I wanted to do a 5-year loan with a 30-year AM, does that also apply? Is that the equivalent to a balloon as well?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. You can't put a balloon in a you could do it if it was an investor buying it. But that's not what you want. You want a homeowner. You can't do it with a homeowner. No, I mean,
what if I can I do a 5-year loan though? Just a strict 5-year loan.
You could amortize it over 5 years. If that worked. I mean, the question is, what do the payments have to be? Can anybody afford that?
Well, maybe if I just did interest only.
You can't do interest only with homeowners, because that's the equivalent of a balloon. When you say it's interest only and it matures in 5 years, that's the same thing. That's a balloon.
Okay.
So you're worried. You're worried that you might want your money back in 5 years.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's other options. You don't have to put that on the owner. You could sell the note, because by that time it's been performing for 5 years, and you should be able to get decent money for the note. You could hypothecate the note. You could borrow against it.
I was really looking at, like you said, protecting against that interest risk more than getting it back. Because I mean, I don't need to get the equity out of it right away.
Randy, what do you have in this mobile home? How much money do you have in it?
Right now, I've got about 115 into it.
And what do you think it's going to sell for?
I think it's going to sell for around 239.
Okay. So forget the face rate on the note. If it's 10%, 12%, 14%, does not matter. What is your rate of return?
No, it's excellent.
Yeah, and the interest rate on the note is almost just like bonus, you know.
Right.
You
could on the cake.
You could basically sell it at 0% interest and probably have a good rate of return, you know. So don't get too bent out of shape about, well, you know, if interest rates go way up, then I'm like somehow losing money because I'm getting 12 and I could get 14 at the bank. That doesn't matter. You're not really getting 14. Your rate of return is a whole lot more than that.
Yeah. Yeah, very good point. Very good point. Okay, well, awesome. Thanks, Vina.
Okay. Appreciate
good
your call, Randy.
All right. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing. It's Question and Answer Week. Last chance. You can call at 877-772-9658 or send an email to vinaradio@gmail.com. Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Vina Jones Cox. It is Question and Answer Week, and we have several questions that have built up here in the inbox of vinaradio@gmail.com. SK in Colorado says that think about stealing houses is disturbing, to say the least. That has been going on for as long as I've been in real estate, but there does seem to have been a spate of those lately, SK. How would I look up that info for my area? The information about whether or not it's an official crime with official prosecution by the officials? I would say it probably would be in your state law. And, like, you know, do you have, like, a revised code kind of thing? Because those are usually pretty well organized into this whole section's about real estate, this whole section's about, I don't know, advertising, this whole section's about. So I think I would Google your state law and see what you can find in there. Question from Dan says, what's the best strategy for locating a lot to wholesale, and then in parentheses, to build a house in the Cincinnati area? So I'm gathering that what you mean is wholesale to a developer or wholesale to someone who wants to build a house. It's not that you're trying to build a house, because if you were trying to build a house, I would say, well, you go to the neighborhoods where you are interested in building a house and you look for lots and you find out who the owner is and you reach out to them and say, would you sell that lot? If you're just looking for lots to wholesale that were build a bowl and in areas that were likely to attract a developer or a homeowner who wanted to build a house, you're going to pick subdivisions where A, there is building going on, infill building. So it's not just somebody bought a big old chunk of land and built a new subdivision there, but like you're seeing that people are tearing down the old houses and putting up new houses, and where those new houses are selling in the Cincinnati area, the key seems to be about 700,000 and above. There are whole neighborhoods where if you drive up the streets, you'll see that it's a combination of like 1950s little branch houses on big lots and then brand new, big, you know, 3,000-4,000 square foot houses that have been infilled. Those are the kinds of areas where you're going to be able to attract people to buy them and where you're going to find lot comps, which is important. And I would look in the same places that I would look anywhere. I mean, I would look in the public records to see who owns lots in those areas. I would follow probates. I would follow foreclosures, all of that sort of thing, looking for those things. But I might also just drive for dollars. Did I mention there's a driving for dollars challenge kicking off tonight at 6:30 on Zoom? And that you can get in on that at CincinnatiRIA.com. You got to register because there's a Zoom meeting tonight to launch it. So that's what I would do, Dan. And I would market to them in all the same ways that I would market to people normally, mail, possibly phone calls, that sort of thing. A question from Nancy in Connecticut. She says, I would like to buy a multifamily 3 to 10 units. My problem is I don't have 20 or 25% to put down. I've heard people say you don't need any of your own money to buy multifamilies and get a private money loan for the 20% down. Would the main lender, whether that was a bank or hard money lender, accept a lien in second position? Would it be a long search to find someone? Okay, so let me answer that part of the question. Most banks and hard money lenders do not want to finance a property where you are bringing 20 or 25% down that is going to then be a second lien against their first lien. In fact, they will specifically tell you, you cannot do that. There are a few like hard money private type lenders that are like, sure, we don't care. We're still only in it for 75%, so we don't care. So you might want to find out who those people are who lend in Connecticut. But the other thing is, that's not the only structure that you can create here. There does not have to be a private loan for you to get your 20 or 25% down. That person who's bringing the other money could be a partner. No lien, just you're giving up part of the ownership. That person could be giving you that money in return for an option to buy the property in the future. I mean, there's other ways to make that happen. So given the I think 95% of all the hard money lenders out there will not let you have a mortgage in second, and pretty much 100% of the conventional financing folks will not let that happen, that you might be looking, you might be wanting to do a different structure. Because the second part of your question is, I'm afraid that with a net of $250, $400 a door, it would not build cash quick enough to pay off the private money lender. Yeah, that's entirely possible, which means one of these longer term structures like an option or a partner would maybe be the better choice. You can always, if you don't like the idea of having a partner long term, you can always get an option to buy back the partner share at some increased value in the future, which you would do by refinancing the property to take them, to take their share out of it. So that's my advice to you, Nancy. Thank you for your question, and thank all of the callers and emailers for their questions. Again, Driving for Dollars Challenge starts tonight, CincinnatiRIA.com. Cincinnati RIA meeting is here in Cincinnati tomorrow night, also CincinnatiRIA.com. We'll be back next week with more information to put you on the path to financial independence through real estate investing. Until then, happy investing.